It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer Kent. We're talking about coyotes with two researchers focused on how these animals adapt and what that means for humans, especially when we encounter them. You can join the conversation. Call 800-642-1234. When have you seen a coyote? Are you concerned that they roam around cities and across farmland? Or does that not really bother you? You can email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Right now, we're talking about the political clash over when voters would replace former U.S. Representative Sean Duffy. He left Congress at the end of September. Governor Tony Evers announced an initial special election date that was criticized by both Republicans and Democrats. The special election is now set for May 12th. New reporting from WisConTex shows that the opening for the 7th Congressional District seat is going to be the longest vacancy in Wisconsin's modern political history. Haley Sperling is a reporter on our WisConTex team. Haley, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with this discussion about filling the 7th Congressional seat that wound up being really political. What happened?
So Sean Duffy represented the United States Congressional District 7, which is northern Wisconsin, and he announced his resignation in August and officially resigned in September. And so what should have been and what normally is sort of a run-of-the-mill process when it comes to special elections became quite entangled in many different laws and reasons. So Governor Evers initially set a primary and election date in December and January, respectively. But that didn't work out for quite a few reasons. He received a lot of initial backlash from both Democrats and Republicans who questioned the date for reasons of partisanship and the fact that the December primary date was the last night of Hanukkah, so having elections around holidays never works out. Low voter turnout was a big question. So he was stuck with a really tough decision when it came to setting this date. And then on top of that, following the various state rules and federal rules and regulations.
And then it wasn't just easy enough to set a new date. We got entangled in this confusion between federal statutes and state law. Break that down for us.
Right. So in the past, like I said, setting special election dates isn't really that big of a deal. But because Representative Duffy is a federal congressman, Evers had to take into account both state laws and federal laws. And so the biggest federal law standing in the way of Evers quickly setting a date and just moving on with the process is known as the MOVE Act. And so this was passed in 2009. And essentially what it does is it sets a period of time that persons living overseas and military personnel have to have for receiving and sending in their absentee ballots. And so this went into effect, like I said, in 2009. And since then, Wisconsin has not had a federal special election. So this problem hasn't come up in the past. But it turns out that Wisconsin's special election laws don't actually line up with the MOVE Act. So the Evers administration was really stuck between, you know, a rock and a hard place when it came to setting a new date. So they actually really had to dig into legislation and figure out what they could do to make things work in this special situation.
And what did they figure out? When will the election happen?
So the election is happening on May 12th of 2020 with a primary on February 18th, which aligns with the state's spring primaries as well. And so this date is actually pretty far out in
right.
setting. Yeah.
The congressman announced his resignation in August, and it won't be until the next May that voters will weigh in.
Exactly. And so in setting the first date, the January and December primary and election dates, you know, Evers said that he wanted to expedite this process and make sure the people of the 7th district get the adequate representation that they deserve. But again, because laws restricted that, he had to move the date pretty far out. And so there's a lot that goes into planning and establishing a special election. You know, it's not just saying, OK, we're going to have an election on this date. But, you know, you need to give candidates time to collect signatures, to run their campaigns, to actually go, you know, knocking on doors and getting people excited to vote. And again, the laws are at play. So it really came down to scheduling a time that was good for the rest of the state and that could actually work within the bounds of the law.
And your reporting also details not only why it's important for candidates, but why it's important for election staff to make sure that the timing is right with special elections and all of the other things that they have to have happen throughout the year.
Right, because there are a lot of, you know, extended costs that go into special elections. And again, you know, like I said, campaigns have to be run and it takes a team of people to do that. And teams have to be hired and they have to be trained and have to be informed. So it's a much bigger process than just getting names on a ballot and getting people to vote. It's the democratic process, which is multifaceted.
Certainly. Haley Sperling is an engagement editor and reporter with WisContext. And we are talking about her latest report that discusses the differences and the nuances of Governor Tony Evers scheduling a special election for an open congressional seat. We may not have had a special election at the congressional level, but we have had special elections relatively routinely at the state level. This did come up under Governor Scott Walker when he was in office. What's the difference there in how he approached this situation?
Yeah, so in 2017, Scott Walker, then governor, appointed two Republican legislators to his cabinet, and then ensued a whole lot. Essentially, Governor Walker said that he didn't want to call a special election and that he didn't have to because within state law, the date of the resignation was before the date that an upcoming election would occur. So the resignations occur in 2017 and the next election was happening in 2018. So in accordance with state law, he said he didn't necessarily have to call the election. This was called into question by residents of the districts of the representatives and eventually went to court and went through a lot of hoops and circles. But Walker did eventually have to call a special election, though with what he wanted, it would have been much longer even than this gap of time between Representative Duffy's resignation and his impending special election. So if Walker had originally gotten what he wanted with this special election case, there would have been a total of 312 days between the time of the election and between the time of the resignations, rather, and the time of the special election. In the case of Representative Duffy, with the election now on May 12th, there will be a total of 232 days between the time of his resignation and the time of the election.
So Governor Scott Walker says, we can wait. We'll just wait till the next election. The courts say, no, you have to do it sooner. Evers says, let's do it sooner. And it turns out federal law requires us to do it later.
Right, exactly. So they kind of both got what the other one wanted. And it's just the way it worked out, you know, the circumstances for each were both very different, but they ended up causing a whole bunch of stir in terms of these special election processes, which is something that before 2017 really didn't happen that much.
Fascinating. Haley, thank you for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Haley Sperling is a reporter for our WisContext team. They're out with a new piece taking a look at how special elections work and why they've become a political flashpoint. You can read it online at wiscontext.org. Up next here on The Morning Show, we're talking about coyotes now that populations have spread across 49 states. Two researchers explain how these carnivores are adapting to urban life, and we want to hear from you. Do you see coyotes where you live? How often do you spot them? Join us at 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We kick off the conversation in just a moment. I'm Keeley Boltina, and this is the Ideas Network. If you tell our next guest that you've seen a coyote in your backyard, he won't be surprised. That's because these animals native to the western part of the country now live in every U.S. state except Hawaii. Those are coyotes howling in Yellowstone National Park, but they're not sticking to the wilderness. We're talking about it on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina, and we want to know what you're seeing in your community. Do you encounter coyotes? What was an experience like? What do you want to know about how they live alongside human beings? 1-800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. We have two guests for our conversation today. Stan Gert is a professor and wildlife extension specialist at Ohio State University. Stan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
And Megan Dreheim is a faculty member at Virginia Tech Center for Leadership and Global Sustainability. Megan, thanks for talking with us.
Good morning.
Megan, let's start here. Why are coyote populations thriving right now?
Well, we've done a really good job of making their lives very easy to live around people. excuse me. I have a little bit of a cough going, excuse me. We've basically created ideal habitat for them to move out east, to move north, to move south, by getting rid of larger predators that keep their populations in check historically. And creating, they do very well in sort of edge habitat where there's a lot of food for them. So a lot of rodents, you know, live around people, a lot of animals like that, rabbits.
And what kind of animals have we cut back the population of that would normally be predators of coyotes?
Well, not so much predators of coyotes, mm-hmm. but animals that keep them out of territories. So wolves, for example, exclude them from their territories. Or tend to exclude them from their territories. So as we've killed wolves, for example, we've made more land available for coyotes.
Gotcha. So it's more about competition there.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Stan, how do we gauge that? How do we know that coyote populations are growing across the U.S.?
Well, there's a couple different ways. So we know that they're growing when we get an increase in the reported sightings. By people, so especially in urban areas, animal control agencies or even police departments will start logging more reports of observations of coyotes in areas where they have not been seen before. And then there's also the more negative aspect, which is we do get somewhat of an increase in conflicts with coyotes. So it may be that a cat might be taken or there might be a coyote that's acting more bold, where, again, in areas where they had not been seen before.
And do we know, is this happening just in urban areas as we are seeing more reports of that? Do we know if they're thriving, I guess, in the wild or more rural areas also?
Well, we have probably better indication in the urban areas where it's a more recent event. But we do know that, for example, states in the eastern part of the U.S., they've had increases in the number of animals trapped and hunted. So the take or the harvest each year in some states has continued to increase, and that's an indication of an increase in population.
And Stan, you started the Urban Coyote Project looking at coyotes in the Chicago area almost 20 years ago. Why did you launch that endeavor?
Well, it was largely because of the concern that the public had in that increase in observations of coyotes. So prior to the 1990s, coyotes were pretty rare in the Chicago system, as they were in most cities across the U.S. And then people began seeing them in some of their neighborhoods, and they would contact animal control agencies for advice or guidance or management. And the agencies really didn't have any information to provide them, and they didn't really know what is the most effective response. And so there was a need for some science-based decision-making, and so that's what we started to do.
Stan Gert has been studying coyotes in the Chicagoland area for 19 years now. Megan Dreheim researches interactions between humans and coyotes in Washington, D.C. And you're part of this discussion. Have you ever encountered a coyote up close? What happened? Are you a farmer? Do you have difficulty keeping coyotes away from your livestock? There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. You can also email us. That address is ideas at WPR.org. coyotes.org. Megan, farther east, you founded your own research project just last year called the District Coyote Project. Why did you see a need to focus on coyotes in Washington, D.C.?
Well, we've had coyotes for even less of a time than in Chicago. The first official sighting was in 2004 in Rock Creek Park, which is a urban national park that we have in D.C. And so they haven't been here that long yet. A lot of people in the city don't even know that they're around. And so we saw it as a really nice opportunity to get on top of conflict before it even happened, you know, to be proactive instead of reactive, which is normally how communities deal with coyotes, understandably, too, right? It's hard to get people to tackle a problem before there actually is a problem. But we've seen what happens when coyotes move into other cities, and invariably there's going to be conflict, whether that's just people not liking the idea that coyotes are around and being afraid of that, or, you know, actual conflict where coyotes are taking cats, things like that. So really it was just a nice opportunity to see what would happen here, and to try out some public outreach techniques to try to, like I said, get on top of this.
That proactive approach. Do we have a good handle on what the population looks like then in D.C. if we've just started really examining this?
No, not really. There's work being done in Rock Creek Park right now, and really that's about it in the city. But we know that they're in some of our other larger green spaces, and we also know that they're using the neighborhoods at least to go from green space to green space, but we don't have a population estimate.
All right. Stan, does that sound like what you're seeing in the Chicagoland area as you've studied this longer, or does that sound like different kinds of behaviors than what you see in Illinois?
No, it sounds pretty typical. I think there may be some aspects of their behavior that might differ somewhat between cities, but there's others that are pretty pretty standard. As each study starts across different cities, we tend to see the same things, which is coyotes they originally begin using green spaces and restricting their activities to whatever green space is available in the cities and really trying to avoid people at all costs. And then as their populations grow, they're kind of forced into the more developed areas, and so they may become a bit more visible to people, but still attempting to avoid people as much as possible. And the vast majority of the animals, and this would be true for probably D.C. and any other city, is that they really aren't causing any conflicts whatsoever. And in fact, in most cases, people have no idea that they're there, even though that they're present. And that would be true for pretty much every single city.
Do you see the animals themselves getting more comfortable with human beings, or do they really, even over the last 20 years of your project, do they really try to keep to themselves even after you've seen generations living in cities?
Right. So that's a great question. And that's actually one of the reasons why we still are continuing this research, because I get asked all the time, well, after 20 years, why are you still doing this? Haven't you answered anything? And we have. But one of our questions is that this is a evolving story, and we don't know exactly what the final chapter of this story is. And so we're continuing to monitor them because we're curious as to whether or not they would change their behavior after years and years of living near people. So far, the story is that they are still maintaining a healthy fear of people, which is allowing them to live with us in relative, you know, coexistence.
And Megan, part of your research project includes people reporting sightings of coyotes and foxes. Do we know where people are seeing these animals predominantly?
Well, just to tack on to what Stan said, it's mm-hmm. absolutely true that coyotes tend to avoid people and really want to stay away from us. So right now we're seeing most of the sightings, again, either near these larger green spaces in D.C. And really, I think that the population isn't so big here yet where they have to leave the parks very often. Every sighting, I believe, that people have had that's been reported to us at least has been at night. And again, that's to try to stay away from us and avoid interactions with us as much as possible. We also get sightings of fox in, and that's much more likely to be daytime sightings, which, you know, makes sense based on what we know about coyotes elsewhere.
Megan and Stan, stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Megan Dreheim studies the intersection of human beings and wildlife populations, especially in urban areas. She works at Virginia Tech's Center for Leadership in Global Sustainability. And Stan Gert researches the population ecology of coyotes, and he's a professor and wildlife extension specialist at Ohio State University. We're talking with both of them and taking your calls about coyotes now. Do you see coyotes where you live? Are you in an urban area in Wisconsin, or do you live in one of the rural parts? Maybe you're a hunter or a farmer. How often do you come across coyotes in your area? Let's talk about it. We'll also take your questions for these experts about coyotes. 800-642-1234. I'm Keely Boltina, and this is The Morning Show. Coyotes are thriving across the country, and a project through the University of Wisconsin is collecting information about coyote sightings. The UW Urban Canid Project focuses on urban coyotes and foxes, arguing that living alongside these wild animals can be safe, even enjoyable. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina, in for Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about coyotes with experts who study their behavior and how they interact with people. You can join the conversation and share your experience at 1-800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Megan Dreheim researches coyote populations in Washington, D.C. and follows the intersection of human-wildlife populations. And Stan Gert studies the dynamics of coyotes in the Chicago metropolitan area. And we also want to welcome Duane from Hayward to the conversation. Duane, thanks for being here.
Yes, good morning. Yeah, I've lived amongst coyotes my whole life. Trapped them, hunted them, collected bounty on them when we had a bounty in the state of Wisconsin. As far as wolves displaced and coyotes, I have plenty of both around my place. The coyotes might move a couple miles away when the wolves move in, but they move right back. The best way to control coyote populations, and they really are a hazard if you have a small farm. They'll eat your chickens and rabbits and kill your small pets. It's hunting and trapping and putting a bounty on them.
All right. Duane, thanks so much for that call and for bringing up that point. Stan, does hunting coyotes help to control the population?
Well, I guess I'd have to disagree a little bit with Duane on that one, which basically the bounty has been tried with almost every state from the Midwest to the West. And so far, there's been no data to suggest that a bounty controls coyote populations at all. So you can hunt and trap coyotes. In fact, most states have no limits on the seasons or how many animals you can kill. And the reason why they're the most unregulated or unprotected game animal is the fact that we don't actually have any success at controlling their numbers. So I guess I would disagree a little bit.
Well, and at least 400,000 coyotes are exterminated each year. The federal government kills some 80,000, according to National Geographic. Stan, is there a difference between government regulation and encouraging individuals to try to exterminate the population? Or is this lethal control just not working, regardless of who's trying it with strategy?
Well, I think it depends on why the lethal strategy is being used. So it can be effective if you want to remove an animal that is causing a problem. So I would agree with Duane that there are times when coyotes will take some livestock, especially lambs during lambing season, or the occasional pet. So when an animal does start developing that habit, lethal control can be effective at removing that individual. So that's an individual removal, as opposed to using it as population control.
And Megan, what do you see as the social drivers between human beings and wildlife in conflict? What's really at the root of this?
Well, it really depends on the animal. A lot of times there are overlying social issues that are actually more important in driving the conflict than the actual interaction between the person and the animal. With coyotes, you know, as I said before, it can be as simple as people don't think that an animal is large or a predator at all belong in a city, right? They belong out in a rural area. And the idea that they're actually living in our neighborhoods is very scary for some people. It can also, of course, be actual conflict. So that's the perceived conflict. There is also, obviously, the potential for actual conflict with coyotes. Stan mentioned small animals, small pets being taken by coyotes, for example. And I want to stress that that's actually a natural behavior for coyotes, right? It's certainly problematic for us humans. It's something we need to address, but cats, small dogs, they're really the right prey size for coyotes. So they're doing what's natural for them, trying to make a living in the city.
So it's not that if you see something like that happening, that is a particularly sick animal or anything. When we see other animal behaviors that are kind of strange to us, that's normal for them.
It is. The one caveat to that I would make is if the dog or the cat are in very close contact to people at that time. So if a small dog is on leash, for example, and a coyote comes in to take that particular dog, then that's obviously a problem because the coyote has become really quite bold around people. And as Stan said, you know, when we have coyotes that are exhibiting behavior like that, it is important to figure out how to take some action.
Marcus in Milwaukee has a question for us. Marcus, welcome to the morning show.
Good morning, Keely. So I work for a bunch of landlords that have units spread across Milwaukee and Waukesha counties. And I've noticed it was brought to my attention from some of the tenants at some units on the north side of Milwaukee. There's apparently a sizable, what appears to be a coyote population. One of them got some video of it, and it looks larger than what I would say a standard coyote. And I guess I was wondering how much do we actually have potentially like coy wolves coming into Wisconsin, where it's the western gray wolf breeding with the eastern coyote?
Yeah, I'm not sure that our guest can speak specific to Wisconsin, but how do we tell the difference? Megan, is that within your scope, coy wolves versus coyotes?
So I actually don't like the term coy wolf so much. Most of the hybridization events that we're talking about happened generations upon generations ago. So really the amount of wolf genes, so to speak, are pretty small. It also excludes domestic dogs. And usually with those eastern coyotes, we also see some dog genes present. So there hasn't been much work out east, at least in my region, on the genetics of eastern coyotes. But there was a study at Quantico, Naval Base, which is quite close to D.C., and they found that, you know, we're talking about on average sort of 10% wolf, 10% dog, 80% coyote. So really we're talking about coyotes here. The interesting things about all these canid species is that they can actually interbreed and have fertile offspring. So domestic dogs, wolves, coyotes, and that's, you know, somewhat unusual. It's not completely unique, of course, but it is somewhat unusual in the animal world for that to happen.
Megan Draheim researches interactions between humans and coyotes in Washington, D.C., and Stan Gert has been studying coyotes in the Chicagoland area for 19 years. We're talking about them together here on the Ideas Network, taking your questions about coyotes, what you see. Perhaps you've encountered one or you have difficulty keeping them away from your livestock. Tell us about it. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. And Lois from DeForest also wants to be part of this conversation. Thanks for being here, Lois.
Thank you. I would like your guest to address methods when there is potential conflict that can be used other than lethal.
Okay. And you're just looking for some ideas about what that might be?
Actually, I've been studying the coyote for some time, and I don't hear much about that, and I think education and outreach is kind of important because we're going to continue to see wildlife interacting with wildlife because their habitat is disappearing, and they're moving into more of the urban area.
All right. Thanks, Lois, for that question. Stan, what do you hear in Lois's question? What are some of the things that she could think about beyond that could be control beyond actually killing coyotes?
Sure. There's a lot of things. So the nice thing about this whole coyote-human relationship is that we can't always control where coyotes go and how many might live in an area, but we can control how they behave. In fact, we do a lot of teaching to coyotes, whether we know it or not. And so there's certain things that we can do. The first and most important would be controlling food, because coyotes will only live in areas where there's food available. And so if we can control the amount of human food that the coyotes are exposed to, then we can actually mitigate a lot of conflict before it ever happens. So that's first. Second would be a little bit of habitat management. So coyotes also need areas to hide and use during the day. And in some cases, people may have brush piles or an overgrown area that might provide cover for coyotes. And so that could be minimized and give them less cover. And so, again, they would have less incentive to stay in that particular area. And then in the case where people actually encounter a coyote, they should always act dominant toward that coyote. They should yell at it, wave their arms, and provide some negative stimulus. Unfortunately, a lot of times what we find is that because people are not that familiar with coyotes, if they do encounter one, they often run away or move away from it. And if enough people do that over and over again, the coyote begins to learn that they can make people go away by simply appearing in front of them. So we try to give them the right message and not the wrong message.
And Megan, do you see humans tolerating coyote populations in urban areas? How might we just kind of shrug it off?
Well, I think that, like Stan said, the most important thing we can do is to control our behavior, to make sure that people understand what to do when they see a coyote. And like Stan also said, to make sure that we manage our own area, our own backyards, our own neighborhoods in a way that coyotes won't feel that it's advisable to come into close contact with people. One of the things about, we call it hazing, when you see a coyote and you try to make it go away from you, it's most effective. There hasn't been that much research done on it yet because it's a hard thing to research, but we do think that hazing is much more effective when a coyote is not bold yet.
Okay.
When they haven't become too comfortable around people.
And we'll talk a little bit more about hazing in just a moment. We are discussing coyotes now, how they live, what's changing, and what that means for people. Stan Gert and Megan Dreheim study different aspects of coyotes, and they stay with us. There's still room for you in this discussion. What do you think about more coyotes living in urban areas? Does that concern you? 800-642-1234. I'm Keely Boltina. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're talking about coyotes. And whether you call them coyotes or coyotes really doesn't matter. National Geographic reports they've expanded their territory by 40% since the 1950s. Stan Gert has studied coyotes living in the Chicagoland area for nearly 20 years, and he stays with us along with Megan Dreheim, who launched the District Coyote Project in Washington, D.C. last year, looking at urban coyotes there. And we've been talking about hazing, trying to scare coyotes away from human beings, and here's a sample from a video put together by Public Health of Madison and Dane County here in Wisconsin.
Face the coyote and stand your ground. Stand tall and raise your arms. In your loudest, firmest voice, yell at the coyote to go away.
Get out of here! Go! Go!
Use noisemakers like pennies in a soda can or a whistle.
Go! Go! Shoot!
Throw sticks, rocks, or other objects in the direction of the coyote. But do not throw food, and do not throw any of these objects directly at the animal.
And Megan, that's an example of some of the hazing that you've been talking about, some of those techniques we can use when we come face to face with a coyote.
Yes, exactly.
And why is that so important for us to have those, I don't want to call them tricks, but those strategies?
Yes, it's really important to keep coyotes shy of us. When they become bold, when they become too comfortable around us, then we can start to see escalating problems. And, you know, even so, it's still a fairly, or, you know, we believe it's still a fairly small percentage of coyotes that would end up causing problems with people and become overly bold with us. But when we see a coyote, a great way to keep it behaving as it should is to haze with a few caveats.
All right. Let's welcome Pat from TOMA to the conversation now. Pat, what's your question?
My question is there any correlation with the coyotes when the winter gets really harsh? I know we see them in town more often. I agree with the one guy there saying that we train them. I mean, when it's garbage day, when it's really bad, we see them ransacking everybody's garbage up and down the streets. But another question would be about rabies. Is there any issues with rabies?
Okay, yeah, because they might be, because we might be exposed to that, or they might be interacting with our pets, those sorts of things. Stan, we know that the animals can interact with one another with coyotes around our pets. Are diseases a concern too?
They're actually not that much of a concern. That's actually a major part of the research that we're doing. So we've captured and sampled over 1,000 coyotes in Chicago, and the vast majority of the population is a very healthy population. In fact, people would be surprised at just how healthy they are. And there's not that many diseases that they can spread to people. And there's a few that they could spread to pets. But in general, they have probably more that they would catch from our pets than what they would transmit to them. But as far as rabies goes, that's a great question. Like any mammal, they could potentially be infected with rabies and then also bite a person, but they don't have a kind of coyote rabies. Unlike bat rabies or raccoon rabies, we don't have a strain in the U.S. That's carried by coyotes. So if they do contract rabies, it's coming from another species. And luckily, in Wisconsin, you don't have raccoon rabies. And so that's what's often has been spilled over into coyotes where that occurs, but it doesn't occur in the Midwest. So it's actually extremely rare, if non-existent, for rabies to occur in coyotes. But to be on the safe side, if for some reason you are nipped by one or bitten, you would have to assume that rabies is a possibility, just like you would for any other mammal.
So some good news in there, some maybe lower risk than we might have imagined, but sure, be cautious. Stan Gert has been studying coyotes in the Chicagoland area for 19 years. Megan Dreheim is also with us. She researches interactions between humans and coyotes in Washington, D.C. And Mark from New Berlin is seeing some things in Waukesha County. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, thank you. So I see coyotes quite frequently around my condominium in New Berlin, and I've always been under the impression that they eat rodents or that they prey on rodents. If that's the case, I really like them. Is that true? And I guess I thought of one other thing. Are they how different are coyotes from foxes as far as what they eat and how they benefit us?
All right, let's find out. Megan, do you want to tackle that one?
Sure. Coyotes definitely do eat rodents, and which is one of the reasons why they do so well in cities. You know, rodent populations tend to thrive around us. So we do provide a lot of natural food for them. And rabbits is another one, a big one, too. In terms of foxes versus coyotes, you know, a lot of the coyotes are extremely opportunistic. They'll eat insects. They'll eat berries. They'll eat rodents, as we talked about. In some cases, they'll eat anthropogenic food, so garbage. But that's actually pretty rare in a lot of the areas that we find them. Their diet varies a lot place to place. But in areas where there is an abundant sources of natural food, we tend to see less garbage in their diet.
Yeah, and Stan, voles, too, I understand.
Oh, yeah, voles. That's probably one of their favorites. So we've done a lot of diet work on the animals, and it would be shocking, I think, for a lot of people to see that a native rodent, which is a meadow vole or a prairie vole, is actually found in a lot of parts of many parts of the city, especially along roadway easements or railroad easements. And the coyotes spend a lot of their time mousing in those areas. So in our population, the coyotes do have a highly varied diet, but one staple over and over again are rodents. And so they're actually performing a service for us, because if you talk about disease, it's actually rodents that carry many more diseases that can be potentially transmitted to people than any other mammal group.
And we don't have time, but Scott from Superior wanted us to know that they've noticed in the northern borders and down in Minnesota that wolves push the coyotes out. So we do have some people here in Wisconsin who are noticing some of that natural competition that we talked about earlier this hour. Stan, in these last few minutes, what do you hope to learn from all of the data you're collecting on coyotes? You know, what can this research teach us?
Well, it teaches us how to better, I guess, respond to animals that move into the cities. It's an important feature of the urban system to have a predator involved. We haven't had a larger predator for quite a while, and in some cases that's cost us because the other animals become overabundant. Having that animal there teaches us something about ourselves, as well as about the animals around us.
And Megan, do you think we can learn to coexist with coyotes?
Absolutely. They are really important animals in our landscape. They do belong in cities. A lot of times people think that wildlife, especially wildlife they're a little afraid of or that they don't like, doesn't belong in cities, but coyotes have proven to us that they do. And I think that one of the most important things we're looking at is how to best convey that message to people and how to best convey the message that we can actually control that conflict. We can't control coyote populations. We can't control how many live here. They are sort of a self-sustaining population, but we can control our behavior and the way we interact with them.
And what's your thought, Stan, on human beings and coyotes?
I think so. In fact, we've already seen it in Chicago. When they first showed up, the general response was to get rid of them. In most cities, in Chicago metro area, makes up about 258 cities, most of them were doing everything they could to get rid of them. And yet all they did was increase their success. So what happened over time is that people did change their attitude. In fact, now very few cities still continue any kind of general removal program. Most people have accepted the fact that they're neighbors, and they're going to have to find some way to live with them.
All right, Stan, thank you so much for joining us.
Yep.
And Megan, we appreciate your time, too.
It's a lot.
Megan Dreheim is a faculty member at Virginia Tech's Center for Leadership and Global Sustainability. Stan Gert is a professor and wildlife extension specialist at Ohio State University. And we've been talking about coyotes in both the Chicagoland area and in Washington, D.C., and also here in Wisconsin. I'm Keely Voltina. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.